Regarding whether or not the constitutionality of the 15-year time bar in subsection F was considered by the CK court, I'd like to say a few words because I litigated that case. And I can, my observations are that subsection F was not litigated, and therefore no evidentiary record was created regarding subsection F time bars. It was exclusively the lifetime bars of subsection G.
And may I just help you? The opinion speaks for itself.
Yes, and it's been brought up multiple times, and I just wanted to point out it was never briefed. It was never granted cert.
I tried to stop that on when it was first brought up.
Okay, earlier, and thank you. Regarding the interest in the Doe case as it relates to the constitutionality of the 15-year time bar and whether or not that was settled, I have to reiterate and I have to try to be as clear as possible that the Doe court terminations were not before the Doe court. They simply weren't. Certainly, the lifetime bars arising from the confluence of AD and HD, which provided for a definition of offense, which was crime DP, PDP, so very, very minor things that led to a lifetime bar without any exception, that configuration was never before the Doe court at all. But I think it's important to make clear that the Doe court was focused on the eligibility to be placed onto Megan's Law and really didn't treat or make any holdings related to termination issues. And then regarding new facts.
Not termination, but as to the bar. The termination was obviously an amelioration of the bar.
Sure.
Right?
The one way that
they weren't on the table because the legislature hadn't made those determinations.
I agreed that the way that the constitutionality it does touch, they did decide the constitutionality of the scheme as it existed. And of course, the 15-year time bar was in the original version of subsection F, but they said very specifically that it related to risk, ongoing risk, and when someone was no more different than anyone else in their neighborhood, they shouldn't be bothered anymore. That when risk subsided, that Megan's Law wouldn't, in fact, be constitutional to continue to impose. Regarding the concept of new facts, especially scientific evolution, justifying judicial review and reevaluation of constitutionality of laws, I would point to JLG, this court in the child sexual abuse accommodation syndrome, utilized science and changed science, evolving science, to strike down procedures that had been very common and had profound impacts in criminal law. State v. Moore, which struck down or deauthorized hypnotically refreshed testimony. And last but certainly not least, Brown v. Board of Education, which was based on social science and the evolution of social science to reevaluate the constitutionality of schemes such as separate but equal. So the law is replete with the assertion that circumstances have changed by some litigant. Many of those changed circumstances arise from the evolution of science or demographics or other things. And then those changes do in fact justify the reevaluation of constitutionality of laws.
Thank you, counsel.
You're very welcome.
Novick.
Thank you, Your Honors, and may it please the court. The Office of the Public Defender has been litigating the constitutionality of subsection F's imposition of permanent lifetime Megan's Law registration for children ever since this court's opinion in HD, We agree with JA that the permanent lifetime registration bar at issue here violates substantive due process. And I want to address 3 points based on the OPD's experience litigating these cases. First, I want to talk about the harms that permanent lifetime registration imposes on children's liberty interests, which is going to respond, Justice Wiener-Apter, to your question about the rights at stake, and is going to address the first two prongs of the substantive due process test, which are the nature of the right and the restriction imposed on that right. Second, I want to talk about the evidence of children's lack of sexual recidivism even after committing a subsequent non-sexual offense, which addresses the third factor of the test, the public need for the restriction. And then I'm going to talk about what the court should do about it.
Mr. Nova, can I ask you a question up front, similar to where we began the earlier argument? Does the constitutional challenge here potentially set a principle that would extend beyond juveniles?
So the record that was created in this case, the record that we've created in our cases, the record that we've tried to submit to the court through our amicus brief is all about children. We talk about the harms imposed on children. We talk about the brain science of children. We talk about the risk of future recidivism by children. We are here today to talk about children.
Understand that. But much of the focus is also on the recidivism, the rate of reoffense. Would the principles being advanced with respect to that apply to young adults as well?
I think to some extent they could, depending on the record that's created. But the case law, a lot of the case law that we're relying on, which includes CK, the Roper line of cases, cases from other jurisdictions, really talk about youth and children. And the kind of children are different jurisprudence. So I think it would be a different case. Would the type of evidence we're providing, if there was evidence similar for adults, support a challenge like that? Maybe, if the court looked at the record in that case and decided it was applicable. But it would be a different analysis. It would be the same, I think Ms. Maynard's right, it would be the same substantive due process questions, but I think the analysis would be different. So I do not think that a ruling in this case in favor of us on children would necessarily apply to young adults, would necessarily apply to older adults. It would be a different record and a different case. Did that answer the question?
Please go ahead.
So I do want to talk about the harms of registration for our youthful clients. In the prior case, Ms. Benarkle said, if they're tier one, all I have to do is come to the police station and register every year. That's the same argument that was made in CK that this court rejected. It's the same argument that the appellate division considered and rejected in the case In Re Registrant AA, which we discussed, that was about procedures for people who move out from here, from out of state, and have a conviction that's arguably similar to a Megan's Law restriction. And it's just completely contrary to the experiences of our clients. And our brief tried to tell those stories, and I want to amplify some of them here and respond to Justice Wiener-Apter's question about what's the fundamental right at stake. The fundamental right at stake is in the state constitution itself. It's a right to liberty and safety and happiness. So Article 1, Paragraph 1 says, all persons are by nature free and independent, have certain natural and unalienable rights, among which are those enjoying and defending life and liberty, of acquiring, possessing, and protecting property, and of pursuing and obtaining safety and happiness. The court has repeatedly emphasized that that's an extremely broad provision, different than the provisions that are in the federal constitution, where you have the tiered analysis of whether something's a fundamental right versus whether it's not, and strict scrutiny or not. The court here in our state has always applied a balancing test and has looked at the nature of the right at stake and the imposition, the need for the imposition of that right, and done a reasonable relationship analysis. So that's really what we're talking about here when we talk about fundamental rights. It's really the fundamental right to due process. And to talk about the privacy and liberty interests that our clients affect our clients in the Megan's Law context. A big one is housing. We talked in our brief about RW, who was a single mother, tried to obtain federally subsidized housing that was specific for single mothers and was not able to do so because a federal statute and regulation prohibits a person on a lifetime registration requirement from obtaining housing. Our client BY has also had trouble obtaining housing. Part of that is because he has an adult conviction for failure to register. That's essentially a consequence of his registration requirement. I'm going to talk about that in a minute as well. And so that conviction comes up on background checks. But there's actually another statute that I apologize we did not cite in our brief that says generally a juvenile adjudication does not come up on a background check. But under the 2022 Fair Chance in Housing Act, the citation is NJSA 46:8-55A1, a landlord can ask even before letting you fill out an application, whether you're subject to a lifetime registration requirement under a state sex offender registration program. And they can look at that even before you apply, or they give you a conditional offer on the apartment and decide to deny you on that basis. Our clients, our child, juvenile sex offender clients, are subject to a lifetime registration requirement and can be denied housing on that basis as well. So housing is a big one. Risks to being outed in terms of privacy and reputation, even for tier one offenders who aren't subject to community notification, these lists are leaky. Our client JU was outed to his family, his stepchildren, who did not know about his registration requirement because a DCPMP caseworker revealed the information to his stepchildren's birth father. And something the state says in its brief on page 16, they say, though it says the privacy interests aren't that great because a criminal conviction is public anyway. That's true for adults. And Doe is a case about adults. I do want to say we're not asking you to overrule Doe, but we were asking you to look at Doe carefully about what it held and what it did not held. Doe is a case about adults. Children, your juvenile adjudication is generally not public. Megan's Law is an exception to that, that implicates privacy interests that are at stake in this case.
It was specifically held that the challenge provisions of Megan's Law do not constitute punishment. Do you disagree with that?
We argued in our cases that these provisions violated the Eighth Amendment and Article 1, Paragraph 12. That's not an issue in this case, but we do believe it constitutes punishment. If we lose this case, we have a case pending in the Appellate Division that raises punishment-based arguments that we would intend to continue with. I will say we cited some of the punishment-based cases in our brief because, and actually I'm going to get into this right now, they implicate some of the harms. Courts in the punishment context have to consider whether there's an affirmative disability imposed by the consequence. And courts in other states have held in holding that parts of Megan's Law are punishment, have talked about this. And I think it's relevant to the implications of the privacy and liberty interests affected by our clients.
So in your other cases with regard to the argument that this is punishment, just with regard to juveniles?
Correct.
Okay.
We've argued with regard to juveniles, it relies, again, on all that juvenile case law, Comer and its predecessors.
Which were all based on cruel and unusual punishment and not on any substantive due process rights, correct? Federal ones that you're basing it on.
Correct. So courts in that punishment context, and I know we're not talking about punishment here, but this is relevant to the implications of your liberty interest at stake in Megan's Law. They talked about how annual registration causes stigma and trauma, which courts have likened to a permanent probation on juveniles. Our children clients, when they go to the police station to register, you know, they say, oh, you just have to go and register. Registration involves going to the police station, being fingerprinted, recounting what you've done, which itself is a source of trauma, especially for children who made mistakes as they were growing up. You have to provide a whole ton of information. My favorite is that you have to provide any device that has internet capability. And as someone who's trying to buy a new stove, I can tell you lots of devices have internet capability. Exposure to failure to register charges is another one. Courts have likened that to revocation of parole, and our client BY obviously had that issue with his failure to register case. There's lots of research and studies on page 17 of our brief and cited in the CK opinion, especially from Professor Letourneau, that talk about the harms imposed on children. These are children-specific studies by Megan's Law registration, including a significant increased risk of suicide. So that's kind of the first two, the one side of the balance, the first two parts of the test, the intrusion, what the liberty interest is and how it's intruded. And then you have to weigh the other side, which is the public need for the restriction. And Justice Wehner, I don't think we're asking that there needs to be a perfect fit with the science in every single case, but these are the weighing decisions that need to happen in the substantive due process context. And so when you're looking at public need for Megan's Law and you're thinking about the need to notify law enforcement and the public of people who are a risk, the science and the data are all 100% clear on our side of the ledger that juveniles adjudicated delinquent do not pose a lifetime risk of sex offending, including if they've committed a subsequent non-sexual offense. CK talks about the brain science behind this. Some of it is kind of coma related, general brain science, youth are maturing, but there's specific brain science and development issues in the sex offending context that are at play here as well. How you grow in and sexually mature and go through puberty and your juvenile, your child sexual conduct does not match what you do as an adult. You're not a pedophile or a predator like adults may be more likely to be if they commit sex offenses. And I think that answers your question, Justice Noriega. You asked about New Jersey specific recidivism data. I don't think we have New Jersey specific recidivism data. We followed New Jersey children and looked at whether they reoffended. But the recidivism data is just backing up the science that we know about how children develop. And that doesn't change whether you're in New Jersey or California or anywhere else. So the recidivism data may be broader than that, broader than just New Jersey, but it's already backing up. It's a secondary kind of reinforcing mechanism about the social, the neuroscience and the brain science and the development that we have already.
Does it matter for purposes of your argument whether the reoffense occurs when the person is a juvenile or an adult?
It does not. My clients RW and BY both reoffended as adults. My client JE reoffended as a juvenile. But the data from Dr. Caldwell, which is what I was about to get into, does not distinguish between a subsequent offense as a child and a subsequent offense as an adult.
But everything you were talking about, I'm sorry, about juveniles being different and their brain still developing, that's not true of an adult.
Right. So if your subsequent offense is non-sexual as an adult, that doesn't affect my argument. If your initial offense was as an adult, or if you have a subsequent adult sex offense, which then puts you in the adult Megan's Law context, that's a different story. But the issue is, if we're looking at people,
sorry, what does that mean? That's a different story.
Oh, so if you are have a child sex offense.
No, I understand. But are you saying the data is different?
The data are different when you get into people who commit the very, very, very few people who commit a child sex offense and adult sex offense. But it's a completely different legal scheme that you're subject to, because you're subject to the adult Megan's Law legal scheme at that point. Right. So our argument wouldn't affect that.
What if the second offense is a sexual offense committed while the person is still a juvenile?
Yeah. So now you're in the same land as we are. And that's exactly the question that the Colorado Supreme Court considered in the TB case. The Colorado Supreme Court said, in that state, you were only subject to lifetime registration if you had two juvenile sex offenses, and the court held that unconstitutional. So the same argument applies.
What does the data show?
The data are that children who reoffend sexually generally do so within the first 36 months, and then they still desist in the future.
Even if the second offense is a sexual offense?
That's true, yes. If you commit an adult sex offense, again, you're in a different category because you're subject to the adult Megan's Law statute. So if we're talking about children, then you're still kind of in our category.
But when you say that it's a different legal construct, that's what does the data say? Are you saying that there is that the data shows what does the data show as to a risk of someone who committed a sexual offense while a juvenile and then commits another sexual offense while an adult?
Those people are in kind of the adult sex offender category, and that's
a
different scheme.
But you're presenting data to us,
right? So
what does the data say about that category?
So I think the data says about that category that you then go look at the adult sex offender data. The data that we're looking at and the class of people we are talking about.
Let me ask you a simple question: is there a risk, a higher risk of reoffense for people in that category than there is for people who have committed a sexual offense while a juvenile but have not had a second sexual offense?
Sure, I would absolutely think so. But that's not the category of people we're talking about.
I understand. Yeah, but so, I'm just trying to understand, because you're saying...
I understand. Yeah. I just want to make sure I'm clear about what our argument is. We've been narrowly focused on the issue of a child who commits a sex offense and then commits a non-sexual subsequent offense, like shoplifting or failure to register. And then the state argues that you're subject to Megan's Law for the rest of your life.
So the data that you discussed at the beginning of your argument with regard to the studies being almost exclusive, almost 100% on your side of the argument regarding recidivism rates for juveniles, that does not include juveniles who later as adults committed a sex offense.
Right. I mean, I think part of it is the recidivism rate is something like 2.75%. So yes, there's some small, very small number of children who will commit a juvenile sex offense and then a subsequent adult sex offense. But part of the issue is that that category is so small. And what the state is seeking to do, the statute is so overbroad that it says any juvenile sex offense and any subsequent offense therefore Megan's Law for the rest of your life. That's the breadth of the statute that we're opposing, that we're saying the data don't support.
For some of the 2.75%, were they subjected to registration requirements like the one at issue here? And is it possible that the risk of recidivism is so low precisely because there are these registration requirements?
The data suggests exactly the opposite. The data suggests that children who are subject to registration requirements reoffend more than children who are not among the class of juvenile sex offenders.
That is the chicken or the egg. If someone has a registration requirement imposed on them, they may have committed a more serious offense than someone who was not.
It could be, but in New Jersey, that's not the case. In New Jersey, everybody who commits a juvenile sex offense is subject to registration, presumptive lifetime registration. I think, by the way, there are ways.
But you're talking about national data, right? And many right. states don't impose the same requirements on juveniles. So can we really say that as a scientific conclusion, that the risk that the person represents, as opposed to the risk that may be minimized by a legal restriction on them, is really an issue?
Yeah, it's correlation and not causation, I think, is your point. And I agree with that. But the issue is that the statute at issue here doesn't make any of those fine distinctions. You could imagine a statute that's better written, that's limited to certain sex offenses, that's limited to certain subsequent offenses. That's not what is before the court right now. What's before the court is a statute that is broader than what other courts have struck down.
Are we in a position, sitting here today, to understand whether the data is confounded by such things as what limitations that an individual has been put under that may in fact reduce the risk of recidivism? See what I'm saying?
Yeah, I think
you're saying, you know, you're asking us to declare a statute unconstitutional on the basis of data. And yet one can certainly imagine many factors, you know, obviously epidemiology is all about trying to figure out why there are the distinctions valid in the two groups and what may be affecting the results in either of those two groups. And it's enormously, people devote their lives to trying to sure. figure all this out.
Sure. And we talked to the experts who have devoted their lives to this, who have all told us the data is all in our direction, number one. Number two is that to the extent the court's review is struggling with what's on the other side, that's a function of how the state has responded to the argument. And I've litigated two of these cases myself, and the same thing happened in this case. The state doesn't come back and say, actually, there's confounding data, Your Honor. Actually, it's not that clear, Your Honor. They just point to the statute and say, rely on the statute. So if there's other stuff out there, we'd welcome the opportunity to see it and rebut it. But we created the record.
From the point of view, from a court's point of view, you and your colleagues are saying we should write an opinion that strikes down this statute, which has been in effect for 30 years, and strike down parts of the statute based upon data that has certain numbers in it without any kind of understanding as to what that data means, because the legislature has made a determination that the protection of victims of sex crimes is an extraordinarily important governmental interest, and that it needs to be addressed. That's the theme of Doe versus Poritz, as it is of the legislative history of the statute. And yet what we're being presented with is data, and with great respect, Mr. Novak, you're telling us that an expert told you the data's all on your side, but that seems to be a pretty thin reed to declare a statute unconstitutional. And I'm sure you're telling us exactly what an expert out there has right. said to you in a meeting or a phone call or whatever. But that's a lot to ask of a court, to strike down a statute because of a conversation that happened between defense counsel, and I'm sure your adversary wasn't on it, and an expert who is unidentified.
Right. So I just want to make a couple of things clear. The data is one piece of the puzzle, right? No one is saying the data is the end of the story, right? I went through the neuroscience. I was going into the data. I was going to go into other court decisions. So the data is one piece of the puzzle. I agree is an important piece of the puzzle. But if the state wants to cross-examine our experts and it's, this is stuff that we submitted to the court in our cases. So they had all that information available to them. We made the experts available for cross-examination. That was declined. We notified the Attorney General when I filed challenges, both of mine. I notified the Attorney General's office when we filed the challenge. The Attorney General's office did not come into the case. The Attorney General's office, by the way, isn't at the table in this case today. So the opportunity has been there for the state and the legislature coming as amicus, for all I care, for them to come back and say exactly what you're saying. There's problems with the data. We created a record, and we are asking the court to review that record. The court shouldn't ignore the record because there's some hypothetical other record out there. That's my point. I don't know if that responded to the question or not, but just to go through the data a little bit, the recidivism rate is below 3% for children. That recidivism rate doesn't change based on whether you commit a subsequent non-sexual offense, which many children do, especially as they're maturing into adulthood. The most recent study from Dr. Caldwell, the Age of Redemption study we cited in our brief, this particular point is made at OPDA 37, is that children who committed juvenile sex offenses were actually less likely to commit a subsequent adult sex offense by age 22 than someone who is adjudicated delinquent of another offense. So the curve actually switches. You've adjudicated delinquent of something other than sex offense. By the time we reach age 22, you're more likely to commit an offense than the person, a sex offense, than the person who committed the juvenile sex offense.
I'll ask a procedural question, but what you just said kind of triggered that with me. Your colleague mentioned JLG in the CSAAS setting, and obviously there have been other settings as well with evidence. The normal in a 702 case, there's a process that happens when there's a challenge to expert evidence, which is what happened there, and there's a hearing, and there's an opportunity by a trial court to make a determination as to the credibility of experts and get sometimes quite deeply into the science. We don't have that here. We have a constitutional challenge that I see as very substantially reliant on science and experts in essence. Can you give us an example of a decision by this court striking down a statute based upon not on a hearing, not on a factual record with respect to the actual science, but on a representation, and with, you know, obviously a lot of work went into this, but a representation by counsel that we've looked at the science and the science supports our position on the unconstitutionality of the statute?
Yeah,
I'm just asking about process.
I understand that.
Brown versus Board of Ed. And that had, as I understand that case, that had a fact-finding process.
Well, on the social science in Brown, I don't necessarily think it did have a fact-finding process. I think it was an amicus brief. I would agree that doing as what we did here, which is submitting stuff in an amicus brief, is a little bit of the exception rather than the rule. But our amicus brief in this case is a little bit unique because we took the record that we created in other litigation and tried to bring it to the court. And I think you've given a little bit of short shrift to what Mr. Maynard did. Actually, Mr. Maynard wasn't trial counsel here, but what trial counsel did in this case, there was a hearing. There was an expert who testified who was subject to cross-examination, and the court has that transcript.
But that's about the individual's risk.
Dr. Norber testified about the Caldwell study. One of the Caldwell studies I talked about, the 2016 study that was available at the time when he testified, the 2022 study was postdated the hearing in this case. But the issue is that when we submit expert reports, the Megan's Law process is generally truncated, right? You don't usually have an evidentiary hearing. So when we've submitted reports in our Megan's Law cases, the state has essentially waived the hearing. So I don't know what you want, Your Honor, wants us to do.
Well, I'm not saying I want you to do anything in particular, but I'm asking you because it isn't quite a match with the expert determinations, which went through a process that is accepted under the evidence rule. Is there a precedent for a studies that are discussed in either an amicus brief or a parties brief being the basis to strike down a statute.
Brown is probably the closest example to that. Brown v. Board is probably the closest example to that. I agree with you. It's not the ordinary course, but we've created the record in the cases that we've had in the Megan's Law context that these issues come up in that the court created a construct where the evidence is usually a paper record. So we've done what we've availed ourselves of the procedures that are out there. And if there are other procedures out there, you know, the court thinks that the record in this case is not sufficient, I submit that it is. But if the court thinks it's not, there, you know, we just ask for an understanding of what it is that we're supposed to do. But again, this is a case where this is not a case where the state came in. I don't even read their brief in this case to say, please send this back for an evidentiary hearing. They don't. There's nothing else there. There's nothing. We've submitted the expert testimony that is there, the science that is there, and our certifications in my cases have all said this is the data, right? So if there was some objection made by the other side, by the state, the attorney generals, excellent attorneys on their side that said there's something else out there in court, you can't rule on this record, I think you'd be in a different position.
Mr. Novak, I think we need to move through the
balance. I understand that. And I'm a little sidetracked now, so I do want to get back to some of our issues. I talked about...
Go ahead. We're closing in on a half hour, so you're probably not going to be able to get through everything you have lined up. Why don't you identify crisply for us the few remaining points you have?
Sure. I was going to talk briefly about the law. Lengthy, unreviewable consequences for children animates CK. It animates Comer. It's animated other courts, CP in Ohio, JB in Pennsylvania, TB in Colorado, TH in Iowa, which upheld its juvenile registration statute only because you could terminate the registration up until the time of disposition. I do want to make this point. The purpose of Megan's Law, right, is that, especially for tier ones, is that law enforcement has a stack. This is not a stack of Megan's Law registrants. This is my cases, but has a stack of people. There's an unsolved sex crime in Gloucester County. The Gloucester County Prosecutor's Office or Police Department wants to go look at the registrants. They pick up the stack of paper, right? They're going to look through it. If you have a bunch of juvenile offenders who don't pose a risk to the public, this is useless. Our position helps law enforcement by narrowing the list of people who are actually going to be investigated, who are worth investigating when a sex crime happens. That point was made in Powell v. Keel, the South Carolina case. I want to talk quickly about remedies, and I want to close about our clients. So our primary remedy that we've asked for the OPD is the remedy in the other case, which is look at the plain language of the statute. And alternatively, these constitutional issues are really about the doctrine of constitutional avoidance. And the Attorney General, I think, made an important concession when it was arguing here in the last case. I wrote it down. The AG said the plain language argument doesn't get us all the way there on their position. So if they're conceding that there's ambiguity, any ambiguity is resolved in favor of avoiding the constitutional question that is posed in this case.
Sorry, I just want to make sure I understand. Are you saying that if we decide the prior case in the registrant's favor, then there is no longer any live constitutional challenge?
That's correct. What we would ask the court to do is set some constitutional boundaries for the legislature to follow should the legislature go back to the drawing board. But yes, if you adopt the plain language argument in RH and TL, part of the reason for which you should adopt it is to avoid the constitutional issue, then there's no need to reach some of the thorny constitutional questions in this case. We would just ask you to set a line, some boundaries, some guidance as to what is constitutional and what is not, because the weighty constitutional issues here would be a Pyrrhic victory if you said in the last case, well, you didn't say adjudication of delinquency in F, and the legislature the next day inserts adjudication of delinquency into that language, and then we have to come back through and do this whole process again. So set some boundaries. That's what we'd ask you to do. Let me close by talking about...
It's a little unusual for this court to address constitutional issues if the statutory question resolves them. Would you agree?
Yes. And I don't know that you need to kind of go through the whole constitutional analysis if you agree with us in the other case that the statute is clear. But I think highlighting that there are constitutional issues at stake if you impose lifetime registration on juveniles and setting some boundaries would be helpful for the legislature as the process continues to unfold.
That would be in the other case reaching a constitutional issue that would not be present. Right.
Well, it would, if the doctrine of constitutional avoidance informs the court's decision, it would be a live issue in that case. If the court really says the statute is clear and we're not going to talk about constitutional issues at all, then so be it. We just think some guidance would be helpful to the legislature as the statute continues to evolve.
Understood. Please go ahead.
I wanted to close just by talking about our client stories one more time. J.U. committed the juvenile sex offense. He then stole Lego from a Bradley's department store. For that, he was required to register for 26 years before obtaining termination on very narrow grounds that don't apply in this case. R.W., after her juvenile sex offense, stole clothes and jewelry from the Livingston Mall. For that, she has now been required to register for almost 30 years with no end in sight. And B.Y., after his juvenile sex offense, failed to register one time while he was homeless and living in a motel. For that, he has been required to register for almost 20 years, again, with no end in sight. The irrebuttable presumption of lifetime Megan's Law for these clients and others for mistakes they made as children and minor subsequent non-sexual offenses cannot be supported by social science, the court's jurisprudence, or the record in this case, just as the irrebuttable presumption at issue in CK was not supported in that case. Our clients have suffered and continue to suffer from the shame, trauma, and collateral legal consequences of Megan's Law, and we ask the court to please issue a holding that gives the children a chance, an opportunity to terminate their Megan's Law registration. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Professor Cohen.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the court. I think Mr. Novak covered most of what amici in this case were hoping to address with you. I'd just like to answer a couple of questions that came up in the earlier argument and make a couple of brief points. So first, I think all of us agree that this case is about the specific implications of 2C7-2F's categorical bar to removal from the registry as it applies to youth. That's what the record is about. That's what we have briefed. That is the issue before the court. With regard to the question that I think you asked Chief Justice in the last argument with regard to whether or not waived youth are incarcerated, the answer to that is yes. If they are sentenced to a term of incarceration, they absolutely are incarcerated. They are incarcerated under 2C. The place at which they are housed may initially be with the Juvenile Justice Commission. And we know that those are defined as juvenile youth facilities under the law. However, they have a conviction. And so subsection F refers to conviction or release from a correctional facility. Most of those youth, unless they are sentenced to very short sentences, are going to be transferred to the Department of Corrections as early as their 18th birthday. It could be as late as their 25th birthday, but if they are serving any kind of a lengthy sentence, they ultimately will, in all likelihood, be in the Department of Corrections and released from the Department of Corrections.
And is that pursuant to statutory language in 2A and some regulations that evolve from that?
Yes, that's exactly right. That is pursuant to the 2015 amendments to the waiver law. Exactly. I also want to point out that, and I think this goes to your question, Justice Wiener-Apter, about the whether or not there's punishment embedded in this. So I think there are only two possible interpretations or operations of subsection F as they apply to children, as it applies to children. The first is that it creates, as my colleagues have said, an irrebuttable presumption of ongoing dangerousness, that there's no way for a young person to refute, even with the benefit of a subsequent public safety analysis. And we know from this court's jurisprudence, from the Supreme Court's jurisprudence, that irrebuttable presumptions, especially when applied to youth, are looked at with great cynicism, if not rejected entirely. That is the essence of individualist consideration. The only other possible operation of subsection F is as punishment. And if it is punishment, it is in violation of what Doe announced to be and recognized to be the purposes, the fundamental purpose of registration and the legislative, obviously the legislative intent of the registration scheme. Either of these applications, either of these operations fails constitutional scrutiny. With regard to concerns about subsequent recidivism, obviously all of those are addressed through the public safety assessment, which is going to be part of any possible removal from the registry for anyone, regardless of whether of when that petition for removal occurs and how long after an adjudication or release from custody that might occur. With regard to the question about the record, and I think this was your question, Justice Patterson, CK, which as you all know far better than I do, was just decided 6 years ago, contained a robust summary of the evidence that was presented at the trial court in that case, and therefore is part of this court's jurisprudence, as is the science, the science with regard to developmental immaturity and its impact on children's decision making that has made its way into Comer and so many other cases decided by this court. With regard to the CK record, that science really hasn't changed that much, except that it's gotten more clear. And as Mr. Novak said, more illustrative of the desistance that occurs as children progress through adolescence, and certainly which becomes complete, which brings them to no greater risk of committing another sex offense than somebody in the general population by the time they hit age 22. And also I'd point out Comer. So there was a record, a testimonial record that was created in Zuber. But when Comer came before this court, there was no new factual record that had been created. The Comer decision-making, of course, was to some extent remedial and was actually addressing exactly the problem that that we're worried would happen here, a legislative abandonment, I suppose. But in Comer, this court announced a new constitutional remedy that was based not on a trial record in that case, but instead on the robust body of developmental science that we have all relied on repeatedly and that this court has fully and fulsomely embraced. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
May it please the court. I will keep this brief as we enter the fourth hour of these collective cases. And I just want to emphasize, in addition to relying on the arguments made by previous counsel, as well as my own briefs, that the purpose of Megan's Law, the whole scheme hinges on the remedial purpose of Megan's Law. And the purpose is remedial to protect children. And the phrase, the protection of children, appears dozens of times in the Doe opinion. And that purpose, not only with respect to the 15-year offense-free bar, is no longer achieved for the reasons that prior counsel have elucidated, it's actually being undermined, because at a certain point, the statute is not protecting kids, it's actually hurting kids. And the kids that Mr. Novak has spoken about, that were referenced in all of amici's briefs, as well as JA's brief, are children who are being hurt by this statute. So the statute is having
you, you say that the Megan's Law statute as it exists today is not protecting kids. That's a factual, let me finish the question. It's a factual statement. It's not protecting kids. How do we know that? And I'm referring here, I understand you're advocating on behalf of juvenile offenders and they are children, but in Doe versus Poritz, the protection of children is about victims. That's the reference to children. So how do we as a court know that Megan's Law is not functioning to protect children? Because that's what you just said to us.
Because some of the children that are impacted by Megan's Law are children who are required to register. And when those children are being required to register and they are no longer a danger to anyone else, it is not effectuating that initial purpose, and any harm that is accruing to those children.
So are you saying that if you look at the child victims, and many, obviously many victims of sex offenses are children, are you saying that Megan's Law is not protecting children? I'm not talking about, I'm not leaving aside for the moment the juvenile offenders. We're talking about potential victims. Is Megan's Law failing to protect children?
I don't think I'm capable of answering that question on the record before you.
But you just told us that.
I'm saying
and
that
you're, and
these
you're, and you're
children.
Asking, you're asking the court to make a constitutional determination based on a conclusion that the statute does not protect children effectively.
If I was inartful in saying what I intended, what I mean is that, and hopefully I'll get it right this time, is that once you exceed the 15-year, once you exceed the purpose, once a child is no longer a danger, which with respect to the 15-year offense-free bar can happen after a child commits another offense, perhaps a disorderly person's offense, a petty disorderly person's offense, or once a child has reached that desistance threshold, but has not yet reached 15 years, then we are no longer in the case where that statute is serving a function, is getting us closer to reaching the goal of protecting potential child victims, and it is imposing harms upon the children who must register. And that's the point at which the court in CK said that we enter into a constitutional challenge. I'm positing that that can arise not just in the state, in the case such as CK, where there's a lifetime bar, but that can arise in the case where you have not yet met 15 years, or in the case where a person has been 15 years, but they haven't been offense-free. So I think what I'm trying to articulate is that it outlives its usefulness, and then it becomes extraordinarily harmful because it does have real impacts, as Mr. Novak discussed, the housing impacts, the mental health impacts. I think all amici wrote extensively in our briefs about that, and I don't want to belabor those points. And by asking that this court find that the 15-year offense-free bar removes the constitutional problem here, by removing that impediment to constitutionality, we're not saying that this court should abolish Megan's Law for children. We're merely saying that consistent with other jurisprudence as to children, the meaningful opportunity for relief must be available to them. And I want to just return to a point that I think is implicated in both cases, is that the second part, the dangerousness standard, is not a toothless standard by any means. Not only do judges have to address that standard, but there's many gatekeepers along the way. If a client comes to me and asks me to file a motion for them to get off Megan's Law because they no longer, there's no 15-year offense-free bar, they were put on Megan's Law yesterday and they want me to make the application today, I have an obligation to make a determination about whether or not that's a frivolous claim. And then I'm probably going to employ an expert who has similar professional motivations to only actually make the finding that the child is, in fact, not a danger if they're not a danger. And then after all of those gatekeepers, then it actually gets to the court, who has the discretion to say that they've met the burden or not. And that issue can be revisited if their dangerousness level decreases at a future time. So I just want to emphasize that the remedy we're asking for, removing this, what we see as a constitutional impediment, does not remove all barriers. It doesn't make every child suddenly off Megan's Law, and it doesn't create a danger. It merely enables the children who are no longer a danger to be relieved of their reporting obligations. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Santoliquido.
The court. Megan's Law is a remedial, not a punitive statute, as this court held in Doe, and it has always applied to juvenile offenders, as this court recognized in Doe and has since recognized in subsequent cases in which Megan's Law, including subsection F, has been applied to juveniles. The questions before this court, the constitutionality of the statute, the first thing that the court looks to when deciding the constitutionality of a statute is that there's a presumption of constitutional validity to statutes. They're presumed to be constitutionally valid. And the standard by which the court determines whether the statute is constitutional when considering the question is whether it promotes a legitimate state interest. And if the state interest is protective of the public safety, the presumption of validity is heightened. And then the question is whether that statute rationally promotes that legitimate state interest. And in fact, as this court said in Greenberg, the question becomes whether there's any conceivable rational basis for the statute promoting that legitimate state interest. And certainly with Megan's Law, as this court held in Doe, that there were very strong state interests and that the statute appropriately and narrowly through its many provisions, complementary provisions, that they rationally promote, that the statute rationally promotes the legitimate public interest of protecting the public, especially children, the most vulnerable members of the public. And that's especially important with sex offenders, juvenile or adult, in this case, obviously dealing with juveniles, but sex offenses in particular, as Doe recognized, as the legislature relied on, that sex offenders in particular have heightened rates of recidivism. And certain sex offenders have further still heightened rates of recidivism, including child molesters. They were found to have rates of recidivism that were elevated even as among other sex offenders, and that recidivism, it continued for many years. And that's actually what we have here. We have a juvenile sex offender who committed a first degree aggravated sexual assault, not against an age peer, but against a five-year-old little girl. And he did so not out of sexual curiosity, as some of the research suggests that juveniles are sexually curious when they commit sex offenses, but he did this to this little girl while he exposed himself and was pleasuring himself. He did this, that's deviant sexual behavior. That was not sexual curiosity. And I think that's an important fact here, the offense that he was committed. And another feature of this offense, and I think that it goes to the research that the registrant and the amici have presented in this case, is that the recidivism rate, it's low for juvenile offenders, and eventually it reaches a point of desistance. Well, the research that there is available, much of it focuses on arrests and convictions, but that leaves out a very large part of the universe of sex offenses. And the research on which registrant and the amici rely recognize that there are limitations. There are sections in these studies, the limitations in these studies. And one of the greatest limitations, among the limitations, is that the types of sex offenses are not distinguished, as opposed to, you know, contact versus non-contact sex offenses. So voyeurism and exhibitionism are lumped in with aggravated sexual assault and child molestation. So the research doesn't distinguish among the different types of sex offenses. But the research also recognizes that sex offenses are a very underreported crime, that many of the sex offenses, inappropriate sexual conduct, is not even reported to the police. And of the, I think one of the studies, it's like half of sex offenses are even reported to police. And then, or I think it's more than half. And then I think it's only 25%. And then of that 25%, only half result in convictions. So many sex offenses go unreported, certainly do not result in convictions. And that's actually what we have in this case here. Because when SH disclosed to her mother what registrant had done, she further disclosed that registrant had done this, had sexually abused her many times previously. So there was a very real risk with involved in this offense. And I think that it is representative of the limitations of the research in this area. The legislature, when it enacted Megan's Law, they had a lot of different research. And this court recognized that. There's a footnote one in Doe, that Chief Justice Willens writes that conflicting studies and interpretations, particularly about the precise numbers, abound, but it is the prerogative of the legislature to resolve those issues. And I
want to ask a question. I thought you had been discussing how sex offenders have heightened rates of recidivism, but then it seemed like you were agreeing that the recidivism rate is low and reaches a point of desistance. So I just wanted to ask, are you challenging the science that the other side says is uncontrovertible, uncontroverted, only in their favor? Or are you agreeing that the science is all in their favor and there's a recidivism rate of only 2%, no matter what the juvenile does afterwards?
Oh, the state does not agree with that. And forgive me if I did not articulate that properly. Their argument is that juvenile sex offenders, they eventually, I think maybe counsel for the Office of the Public Defender said that eventually, one of the amici, I think, said that eventually juvenile sex offenders, they reach a point of desistance and that they're even less likely than members of the general public to offend. And I don't think that the research bears that out. And it's because the limitations in that research.
Counsel, is there research that was cited in your brief or that you can point to that would help us reach that conclusion that you just told us?
Not in my brief, but in the studies that Registrant and Amici present to the court, the studies have limitations sections, and they talk about those limitations as I discussed. So the research is not irrefutable as Registrant and his Amici contend.
But do you have conflicting research to refute the studies with regard to the recidivism rates of the individuals that were prosecuted and convicted of these crimes? Because I know you note that one of the limitations is the fact that sex offenses are underreported, but the rate of recidivism in those studies focus on the individuals who the sex offenses were reported and they were prosecuted. I mean, correct?
Yeah, yes.
But there's also that category of individuals who were actually prosecuted. Are you arguing that the rates of recidivism for those individuals in those studies is inaccurate? And if so, what studies do you have to show that?
I don't know that it's inaccurate, but it's not complete. Well, it's true as far as it goes, but it limits the universe in a way of sex offending that doesn't present a representative picture.
Right. I mean, you could say that about a lot of crimes, right? Like not everyone that sells drugs gets arrested and convicted, and therefore you can't have a full picture of everyone who would recidivate after committing that offense. So I'm trying to get an understanding of what your position is on the rates that they do have in the research that they have presented, just simply that it's not the full picture.
Well, also the research that is presented focuses on the recidivism rate. And I know that the number that is used is 2.75% recidivism rate. Well, that 2.75% recidivism rate also includes, it was a range of following offenders after their conviction or their release. And in some cases, as short as 12 months. But in that same study, when it brought it out to 5 years, 60 months, and then 10 years, the rates of recidivism went up to about 9%. And the ATSA guidelines, they talk about base recidivism.
Over time. So the 2.75 recidivism rate is only at what point in time?
The study looked at offenders for between, I think, 12 months and like 40 something months. It was a range of time. So some of the offenders included in that 2.75%, it had been only a year.
And but you're saying that the recidivism rate is 9% when you follow offenders for what?
For 10 years. I think in that same study, it was about 8.9%, almost 9% when you followed it out to 10 years.
Let's look at JA for a second then, because you relied heavily on the facts of JA's case and what happened in this instance. Am I mistaken, or did the record reflect that the court declined to find that JA posed a danger to society, right? The court did not find that was a danger to society. The only factor barring removal from registration was this additional offense that was a non-sexual offense. Is that fair?
For JA in
this case.
Oh, in this case. Yeah, it was correct. The motion court found that the 15-year bar applied, and JA had two additional offenses, a theft by receiving a year after he was adjudicated delinquent of the first degree aggravated sexual assault, and then a year after that, adjudicated delinquent of robbery, second degree robbery. And it was on that basis that the motion court found that JA is ineligible for relief under subsection F. The court did go on to find that Registrant met the safety prong, that Registrant was not a risk. But as I think maybe Justice Patterson had indicated, there was not a full picture here. And I think one of the Amici said that The state hasn't presented any other research. Well, there was no need to do that because there was the 15-year bar. So there was a one-sided presentation. But as this court recognized in Doe, studies, conflicting studies and interpretations abound. There's other research, but even then the research presented.
So they were challenging the 15-year bar based on data. And you seem to just say that there was no need to introduce any conflicting data because the 15-year bar exists.
Yes.
But I don't understand. They're saying the 15-year bar should no longer exist because all the data is on their side. And you're saying we don't have to put up any conflicting data because the 15-year bar exists?
Well, under the law as it is, because J.A. was not going to be eligible for relief, he still had the hearing. And I think maybe to Justice Noriega, your point, there was still a hearing in this case.
To justify the constitutionality of the bar. They're attacking the constitutionality of the bar on the basis of data. Correct?
Correct.
So is there any conflicting data to justify the constitutionality of the bar?
I think the conflicting data is in the research that they present in the serious limitations in this study. But another of the data that's actually in, I think it's the Amici ACLU, I think it was to your point, Justice Wehner, after about the overall effectiveness of Megan's Law. And I think maybe the Chief Justice, maybe Justice Patterson, about the like overall effect of Megan's Law. And it's actually in the that's a 2008 study that Amici ACLU that they present, Kristen Zagoba et al. From December 2008. And that study, it looked at trends in New Jersey in the 21 counties and statewide. And it actually, it found that there has been a marked decline in sexual recidivism since 1994. Now, the authors point out that there was a decline prior to 1994, but there was a steeper decline after 1994 that continued. And it was reflected in the fact that county by county, with two exceptions of the 21 counties, the highest rates of sexual recidivism were prior to 1994. And the study went out to, you know, past 2000. And that subsequent to 1994, the rates went down. And the researchers actually point out, after acknowledging that there was an already a decline prior to 1994, they write, it is nevertheless hard to explain the steeper decline in rates after the implementation of Megan's Law. Given that sex offenses are low base rate events, the finding that these rates continue to decline at an accelerated rate after 1994 suggests that something other than a natural decline may be responsible. And they add, although the initial decline cannot be attributed to Megan's Law, the continued decline may, in fact, be related in some way to registration and notification activities.
So when your adversary is saying that there comes a point where a juvenile offender is a safer citizen in society than perhaps someone who's never been convicted or has been has not been adjudicated delinquent, could that be in part the result of restrictions imposed by Megan's Law?
I think so, yes. I think that's the idea with Megan's Law, that there was going to be a form of passive community supervision.
I asked that question, though, to your adversary, and he said, to the Office of the Public Defender, and I think he said, actually, it's the opposite, that people who are required to register recidivate more than people who are not required to register.
Well, part of that, I think, is to Justice Patterson's question that those who need to register and who are more likely to recidivate, they are tiered at a higher level and their rates of recidivism go up. So there's some correlation versus causation aspect to this. And
do you have a counter to that, those statistics, with regard to what Justice Wehner-Apter just stated?
I don't have any research myself on the point, but the most likely offenders, juvenile or adult, who are most likely to reoffend, they're also most likely to be on Megan's Law. And so they're going to have higher rates of recidivism potentially. But the way to ameliorate that for offenders who are not as likely to recidivate is through the tiering process. And that's actually something that this registrant has not availed himself of the opportunity, if there are changed circumstances, to re-tier. He's tiered as a tier two. He was tiered as a tier two in 2004, 20 years ago.
Given your comments about the history and the new offenses, would your office oppose retiering?
My office, if the registrant, if he wished to retier, we would investigate. It's not something that we would concede, but we would certainly take the opportunity to determine whether any of the factors are changed. I mean, the RRAS, but it knowing, has those certain elements.
But knowing your position that you gave us today on the type of offense the original offense was and the nature of the additional subsequent offenses that you spoke of that were very harsh offenses right at the time, would those cause your office to usually object to retiering?
Those are accounted for in the offense characteristics portion of the RRAS, but there are community engagement and treatment aspects among the four parts of the RRAS. And for instance, in 2004, when registrant was young, he was unemployed. That was 3 points there toward the total. Well, he has a job now. And that's actually one of the key facts about this case, that registrant, he doesn't identify any liberty interests that are implicated in this. And the Office of the Public Defender, they point out the harms in general to other offenders. But registrant in this case, he has not been prevented from reintegrating into society. And that was part of the promise of Megan's Law, that it was going to be a way for the community to protect itself, but in a way that would not inhibit registrants from reintegrating into society.
Counsel, following up on Justice Noriega's question, you have a command of the record. Based on what you know, if an application for a hearing to assess his tiering were submitted tomorrow, would your office oppose it?
My office would consider, I looked at the RRAS that JA was conducted on JA's behalf, I think in February 2004, and it scored him at a 48. Depending on the retiering, just my assessment, I'm not a Megan's Law prosecutor, but some of the factors, including the length of time since the last offense, that's another factor. And he got several points for that in 2004. Well, there's been a longer period of time. He might get as many as 12 points off. I don't want to hem in my office on that position, but certainly he has employment now. That's 3 points off. He might be tiered as a tier one. There are opportunities for relief. And that's what's so important to this court about statutes that impact juveniles, whether there's an opportunity, whether there's an avenue for relief. And subsection F provides that. And this court recognized that in CK. CK was seen as a safety valve by this court, that subsection G, there was an irrebuttable presumption, but that subsection F was looked at in conjunction, necessarily, as Justice Abin wrote, in conjunction with subsection B, because it provided an avenue. And this registrant, he had that avenue. And it's significant that the opportunities that were provided for rehabilitation to this juvenile, he did not avail himself of those opportunities. Instead, he offended again, and then a second time, very seriously, with a robbery after that. So he had opportunities to rehabilitate. And as this court has found with the waiver statute, for instance, when the court upheld the waiver statute in 2016, it recognized that a significant consideration is whether the individual, the juvenile, has a juvenile delinquency history, and whether the juvenile has been in a juvenile justice commission facility and been offered opportunities for treatment and rehabilitation, and how he has responded to that. And so it's significant that a juvenile who has been offered opportunities for relief, who does not take those opportunities for relief, is differently situated from juveniles who have offended only once. So the question under subsection F, the 15-year offense-free bar, that it's significant as part of the legislature's overall scheme, and as this court recognized in Doe, that the parts of Megan's Law are complementary, that they operate in harmony, that there's a careful balance, that the legislature thought this out about how to best protect the public without impacting unduly on registrants. And the 15-year bar was necessary because it was an opportunity for registrants to performatively demonstrate that they have rehabilitated, that they have gained an ability to comply with the law.
But you say he missed an opportunity to rehabilitate. The judge found that he's led an exemplary life since the juvenile adjudications, but was constrained by the mandate of subsection F. What good does that serve at this point, being that now the person's able to live an exemplary life and a productive law-abiding citizen?
And that's to registrant's credit that he is.
But what good does it serve the community? Where's the rational basis to the protection of society at this point relative to this particular individual?
I think the Zagoba study from 2008, it shows with the declines in sexual recidivism after 1994 that Megan's Law provides a useful check on sex offenders. And I think that's especially necessary, not depending on the type of sex offense. And here, it was a very serious sex offense.
So and you're involving, there's still a risk of recidivism with this individual?
There certainly is. There certainly is a risk of recidivism.
On what?
It was actually on... In the hearing that was conducted in this matter before the motion court, registrant presented expert testimony from Michael Nover. And it was actually on the cross-examination of Mr. Nover, where he indicated that he relied on a study and it pertained to adult sex offenders, but he acknowledged that adult sex offenders who commit subsequent non-sexual offenses recidivate at a higher rate. That's significant. Because this registrant, he did that, and in a very serious way, and in a way serious enough that doesn't allow for expungement. And I know that came up in the previous case, and I think that's a significant consideration as well, because registrant and Amici, the Amici in particular, registrant as well in his brief, points out that any subsequent offense prevents a, within that 15 years, prevents termination under subsection F. So it could be littering, a petty disorderly person's offense. Well, if it's a nonviolent minor offense subject to expungement, then even under subsection F, there would be the opportunity for expungement. And some of the other counties, they do avail themselves of that opportunity. And I know from my own experience when I was a prosecutor in Atlanta County for gun permit applications, for instance, that under Chapter 58, the firearm laws, that if an individual has a criminal record, they are barred from having a firearms purchase identification card, a carry permit. And I remember in two, maybe three of my cases that the applicants had criminal convictions. One was a minor drug conviction from like 1985. And the way that that was resolved, that the matter, the firearm appeal was administratively dismissed, allowing for the registrant to apply for an expungement and then reapply to the police department afterward.
But here, if you were aware, you would be aware that the matter had been expunged, correct? The prosecutor's office would know it for a registrant who is applying to be removed from Megan's Law, the prosecutor's office handling it would know that they had an expunged matter, correct?
I don't think that we would necessarily know.
The state would be aware of the person's criminal court history, and they would know exactly what matters they've had, even if it was expunged.
So expunged, it would remove it from the rap sheet. So we wouldn't know unless we did some digging. But it wouldn't be a permanent, it wouldn't be an automatic bar. It would allow for the second prong of subsection F to take place, and that the registrant would have an opportunity to demonstrate that he's no longer a risk of harm to others. So if it's an expungible offense, and it wouldn't come up automatically, but if it were discovered by the state, it still would allow for termination if the registrant could prove under the second prong of subsection F that he's no longer a danger to others.
So you're conceding that an expunged offense could not on its own constitute an offense for purposes of the 15-year bar?
No, it could, Your Honor. It certainly could, but it wouldn't, though,
and that it's all about the discretion of the judge as to whether the person is still a harm to the public.
If the registrant were to avail himself of expungement, and if that expungement were granted,
correct,
then there would be an opportunity to establish to the judge that the registrant is no longer a risk of harm to others. So
that means the 15-year bar would not apply. That's what I'm asking. If someone has an
correct
a second offense, it is expunged. Yes. Does the 15-year bar apply?
No, it would not, because then there would not be a conviction at that point for an expungement. The effect of an expungement is that it is not a conviction. So the registrant would be able to truthfully say that he has not been convicted of a subsequent offense.
That's not true for all purposes, though. Somebody is prevented from getting to PTI, from drug, or all sorts of other areas of the law, despite having expunged offenses, because it's not necessarily deleted as a conviction for all purposes under the 2C.
That is true, Your Honor. The expungement statute does provide for certain opportunities, parole board considerations, for instance.
So a prosecutor's office could take the position that, well, we can still consider a conviction for purposes of the 15-year bar.
We certainly could, because there's another provision in the expungement statutes where the state can apply, or I think it's anyone, can apply to the court for an order releasing the expunged records for legitimate purposes. But the point is that it would not be an automatic bar. It would not run afoul of the 15-year offense-free bar. It would provide an opportunity for relief.
It sounded like you just told Justice Noriega that it would apply. The only thing we're asking, if there is a prior offense and it is expunged, does the 15-year bar apply?
No, it does not apply. And then the registrant, would have to then convince a court by clear and convincing evidence under the second prong, the safety prong of subsection F. But here, so there are avenues for relief, but there's also the avenue for relief under the 15-year bar itself. And for registrant and his amici to argue that the 15-year offense-free bar shouldn't apply, that's essentially asking for a right to reoffend, that they should have the ability to commit another offense and that they shouldn't undergo any consequences as a result.
You're saying the relief under the 15-year bar is don't reoffend. Is that the relief that you're referring to that registrant here did not avail himself of, that he would have been able to seek termination after 15 years, but because he reoffended, he didn't avail himself of the relief of not reoffending.
That is correct. He had opportunities to prove through his conduct that he had gained an ability to comply with the law. And that's significant because it's one thing to present studies. In my experience as a prosecutor, defendants, juveniles, and I was a juvenile prosecutor for a period of time, they often do their best to present their best selves to the court. They want, because they want something from the court. But actions speak louder than words. And that was recognized by the legislature when they included the 15-year offense-free bar in subsection F, and that this court has always applied to juveniles. I think as Justice Patterson, as you mentioned in the previous cases, Megan's Law has applied to juveniles for 30 years. And
has anyone... Is there any research out there with which you are familiar that tries to unravel the question whether decreases in recidivism in, as I understand it, 50 states have some form of Megan's Law. It varies, but 50 states and many countries have Megan's Law, that decreases since Megan's Law began here or perhaps elsewhere, do those decreases have anything to do with the fact that there are greater restrictions on individuals who have committed sexual offenses than there were before Megan's Law? See what I'm saying? The impact of the restrictions on recidivism, which is the whole purpose, as I clear in the legislative history, clear in Doe versus Poritz, that the whole purpose of Megan's Law is to deter sex offenses.
It was to provide a check and a way for the community to keep itself safe, and children in particular. And I think that the study that Amicus ACLU points out, that 2008 study, that shows that there was a steeper decline that may be attributable to the registration and notification provision, that Megan's Law has had an effect, but that it's had an effect in such a way that it has not unduly burdened certainly this registrant who's been able to reintegrate into society.
So do we know that whether the science that's being presented to us as a basis to strike down one aspect of Megan's Law, in this case the subsection F 15-year bar for juveniles, may in fact be in part responsible for the decrease in recidivism that the studies show?
That certainly could be, and I think that the question really is for the legislature. The question for this court as to the constitutionality is whether there's a rational basis, a conceivable rational basis. And as this court recognized in Doe, conflicting studies and interpretations, especially including about precise numbers, abound, but it's the legislature's prerogative. I don't think what we would know what would happen if we unbalanced this carefully balanced statute that the legislature enacted, because the research is not clear. And I think that the court recognizes, we're not sociologists, we're not epidemiologists. There's other research, and I don't think that the court or the parties are equipped to properly investigate that. That's a question for the legislature, that they can hear both sides. They can hold hearings where all the stakeholders can present the evidence. We didn't have that in this case because we had the 15-year bar. So there was a one-sided presentation to the motion court. But I think there's also a one-sided presentation here before this court. But the legislature would be able to see the issue from all sides.
And can you help us with a slightly different point? And that is potential tension between the juvenile code and Megan's Law with respect to Section F in this respect. A juvenile and a person age 14 cannot be waived up to adult court. But a 14-year-old, if they commit a second offense, can be subjected to lifetime mandatory registration. How do you reconcile that? Is that a relevant concern?
I think it's a relevant concern, but again, Megan's Law is not punitive. It's remedial. And actually, that's one of the most emphatic points of this court's holding in Doe, that Chief Justice Wilenz, after going through all the ways that Megan's Law is remedial, says, but none of that even needs to be said because it's so clearly remedial. So if Megan's Law is not punitive, so yes, it can apply to older juveniles, even if the 14-year-old could not be waived, but it can still apply. And this court in JG found that Megan's Law, reconciling Megan's Law and the Juvenile Justice Code, found that, you know, rather than overturning the legislative will, it accommodated the legislative will by finding that Megan's Law applies. In that case, it was a 10-year-old. So Megan's Law can apply because it's not punitive. And this court recognized in State versus Brown in 2021 that a key consideration for the court in Doe was that Megan's Law is remedial, and it's purely remedial. So it's not a question that the individual is being punished. J.A. is not being punished. He doesn't even identify any harms that he has suffered. And the other incidental harms that are identified by Amici, there's a question of correlation versus causation. It's not necessarily, it's not clear that it's because they're on Megan's Law in this state or the other states. Megan's Law in this state, it's very clear.
One of the things I thought that Amici were arguing is that you are barred from applying for public housing if you have a lifetime registration requirement.
I think registrants are disallowed from applying for Section 8 housing, federal public housing assistance, but that doesn't bar them from any other housing. And Megan's Law itself, 2C:7-16, lists Megan's Law is not about what a registrant can't do. The only provision in Megan's Law that provides a restriction on registrants is 2C:7-23. Where registrants cannot participate in youth serving organizations, so sports teams. But 2C:7-16 lists all the ways that registration under Megan's Law cannot be used against a registrant. And that includes housing and accommodation, also loans, insurance, education scholarships.
It is used against a registrant in housing.
For the Section 8 housing, because the statute recognizes except as otherwise provided by law. So the federal government disallows, but there's no ability for other communities or other organizations to impose those restrictions. That was actually considered by the appellate division, I believe in 2008, GH versus Galloway Township. It involved Galloway and Cherry Hill ordinances that prohibited registrants from living within 2,500 feet of a school, a park, playground. And the court in that case recognized that there were like 100 municipalities throughout New Jersey that had enacted similar restrictions on where registrants could live. And the appellate division found that that was preempted. They overturned those ordinances by Cherry Hill and Galloway, finding that it was preempted by Megan's Law on different bases, one of which was under 2C:7-16, where housing and accommodation cannot be impacted by registration. So Megan's Law does not tell registrants what they can't do, again, with the exception of 2C:7-23, youth serving organizations. But it doesn't restrict registrants' ability to reintegrate into society. And I think
you agree that if somebody's in the position of applying for Section 8 housing, that they may not have a multitude of options available to them, and that could cause a harm in terms of them locating suitable housing.
That could, but as this court recognized in Doe, if there are incidental harms, but the purpose and the implementation of the statute, Megan's Law, is remedial and not punitive, that incidental harms do not convert the statute into a punitive statute. Now, where this court found that there was a punitive aspect of Megan's Law in CK, it was because of the irrebuttable presumption under subsection G, but it found specifically with respect to subsection F, that subsection F was a safety valve, that it provided a way, an avenue for relief. And that's what has concerned this court and the US Supreme Court in the Roper line of cases involving in the punishment context, but that juveniles would not be afforded an opportunity. This juvenile was, and he stands in a different position because he did not avail himself of the opportunities for rehabilitation.
Counsel, I'm afraid we have to draw the argument to a close. Any other questions? I just have one.
Yes.
Is there any reason to think the Attorney General is unaware of this constitutional challenge? The AG is in the first case and the third case today, but is not here defending the constitutionality of the statute. Any reason to think they're not on notice of this matter?
There's no reason for the state to believe that they're not on notice. I think that they are on notice. I can't address why they did not come in.
Not asking you to. Thank you.
They are aware, yes. But just to conclude, Megan's Law has a remedial purpose. It always has encompassed juveniles, subsection F included, and it provides an avenue for relief. This juvenile, this registrant, failed to avail himself of that, but it was available, and that is the key. If there's an avenue for relief, and the statute, the standard is whether there's a rational basis. In this court in 2014, State versus Lenihan, even if the constitutionality of a law is fairly debatable, the court will uphold the law. The constitutionality, the rational basis is clear in this matter. The state respectfully asks that this court find that subsection F, under these circumstances, is applicable, is constitutional, and the state asks that this court affirm the judgment of the appellate division.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Maynard, very brief rebuttal, please.
Your Honor, much was said that I believe needs and deserves some mention of rebuttal.
Have in mind 5 minutes on the clock. Go right ahead.
Thank you. Megan's Law is not punitive until it is. That means that when the infringements of Megan's Law stop being necessary because a person is no longer a threat to the safety of the public, then it transforms the infringements of Megan's Law from remedial to punishment. Subsection regarding expungements. Subsection F says commit an offense, doesn't say be convicted of an offense. So expungement is not going to alleviate the bar determination. First of all, expungement doesn't mean that the material disappears or goes away. It's in an expunge facility. It's accessible by the state. I've had many prosecutors oppose expungement based on things that they felt were substantial, and that could include once the premise of an expungement allowing the termination of Megan's Law becomes known to the prosecution, I would posit that they would oppose virtually every petition for expungement that could have that implication.
He might oppose it, but he said it's not a bar. The 15-year, you know, the bar doesn't exist, but it doesn't mean it can't be considered as a factor in determining whether the defendant is a risk to the community. Yeah, maybe considered. All he said was, it's not a bar. You're saying now it is a bar in any event?
Well, under HD, commission, not convicted of an offense, but committing an offense would implicate the lifetime bar. That's what we're opposing here with JA, is the lifetime bar determination based on the commission of an offense in the first 15 years.
Sorry, say it one more time. You're saying that I heard you argue that the prosecutor can oppose expungement. I understand. Then there is no expungement. Mm-hmm. But if there is expungement, you're still saying that that counts as a conviction for the 15-year bar.
Well, it's not necessarily a conviction, but the statute, subsection F, doesn't say convicted of. It says commit an offense, right?
So you're saying that matters for purposes of the expungement statute?
I'm saying you may not get that. You may possibly not have an expungement for something that was committed but never resulted in a conviction.
I don't mean if the prosecutor opposes expungement. I understand then there mm-hmm. is no expungement. But if it is expunged, then the 15-year bar is not expunged.
speaks about conviction, not about commitment of an offense.
Okay, that's fine. But the I don't think that expungements, because expungements are not complete elimination of the information, and because there's no prohibition from a prosecutor opposing the termination based on, or the application of HD based on a conviction, even if it was expunged. There's no law that says that. As we stand here now, there's nothing to assure me that an expungement would in fact result in HD not applying to impose a lifetime bar. And there's nothing to ensure that a prosecutor wouldn't oppose a termination of Megan's Law based on expunged records.
Mr. Maynard, I misspoke. I was focused on the language about after the 15 years following conviction or release. Prior to that, it speaks about commission of an offense.
Thanks. I've had terminations opposed because of the commission of offense without the conviction. Regarding the decrease in the sexual offense statistics from 1994 to now, I would posit to the court that if they made the proper inquiry in the science, they would find that the reason is because prior to 1994, there were very, very few scientific studies of sex offense recidivism. They were conducted, just a handful. They were all conducted on extremely high risk offenders, and therefore their results were high rate, high risk of recidivism. And then since Megan's Law was passed, it sparked a great deal of interest in our society, and massive amounts of study then occurred. So there was a lot more study that showed much more realistic rates of offense.
One more minute.
There's too much. First, the state misstates what the Greenberg test is. Very important to understand. The state articulates any conceivable relation to a legitimate state interest. That is the federal rational relationship test. It is not the New Jersey Greenberg test under the New Jersey Constitution, which requires a real and substantial relationship to an appropriate state interest. Also, the Caldwell study said that the 2.75 recidivism rate for juveniles at the time of adjudication endured well past 36 months. In the Doe era, regarding tiering, the RAS, the vast majority of points on the RAS are from the static factors, and so they dramatically overstate risk. And the RAS itself stops functioning after 5 years because there's nothing on the RAS to account for decreases in risk after 5 years. So to say that, and the case BB, which was also one of my cases, determined that the use of the RAS should be for tiering at the initial phases of being placed on Megan's Law. It should not be used in relationship determinations.
Counsel, I'm very sorry that we just don't have more time.
One more sentence, Your Honor, if I might. I have there is a case right now pending certification before this court, MJB, that has made a motion for a special master to be appointed. I believe, based on the interests of the court in all of these things and on the technical, the quantity and technical quality of all of these facts, which are all essential to determining and getting all of these issues determined properly. We have made a number of 104 hearing requests for 702 evidence to be assessed as it relates to recidivism rates and so on, virtually all denied, couldn't even get a hearing. But we have made a motion to this court for the appointment of a special master.
We can't resolve that in this case.
No, but I'm letting you know that for this case and all of the questions that the court had, really great questions that go to that must be answered to properly adjudicate. I believe that a special master process, as in the child sexual abuse accommodation syndrome situation, would yield the evidentiary record adequate to respond to every question I heard the court ask today, and it would allow those adjudications. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel, and thank you to all counsel in this matter.